Okay, hello and welcome to Conscious Conversations, where I introduce you to change makers who are using creative means to make a positive difference in the world. I'm Erin Sharaf, and today it is my great pleasure to get to introduce you to Rivera Sun. Rivera is an author and an activist, and she has written numerous books and novels, including The Dandelion Insurrection and its sequel, The Roots of Resistance. She travels nationwide teaching workshops and strategy for nonviolent movements and is the co-host of Love and Revolution Radio. Her essays on social justice and nonviolent action have appeared in over 100 journals, including Popular Resistance, Truth Out, and Counterpunch. And she says so many profound things, like radical is the new sensible, when fear is used to control us, love is how we rebel, change comes from withdrawing our consenting cooperation from that which we oppose. And it's time to stop living life as usual and to live a life unusual. So welcome, Rivera.
Thanks, Erin.
And so Rivera and I actually met at a gathering of Indigenous people up in Northern Maine. And speaking of a life unusual, you have lived, it sounds like, quite a life unusual and of your own making, Rivera. And so if you don't mind just taking a couple of minutes at the beginning to let anyone listening or watching get a better sense of who you are and your journey, because you've been a playwright, a choreographer, a dancer. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you created a dance company that toured nationwide. You live or have lived in an earthship in the high desert of New Mexico, which I actually have looked into. So I would love if you could say a few words about that. So just give us a sense of who you are in your journey, and then we'll talk about your important body of work.
Great. So I grew up on an organic farm, which I'm actually sitting at right now in northern Maine, right on the border of Canada. And that, I always like to joke, is my first experience doing activism, was building new systems that create the right livelihood and local economies. In college, I ended up studying theater and dance and did have a touring dance theater company that performed in the Bay Area for a number of years and also did shows all across the nation. And that culminated with a series of three solo shows that I took on tour. At the end of that time, I moved to New Mexico, where I started writing novels and started, this was after Occupy, and so I started doing more activism and getting more engaged. And so a lot of my novels that I write now are social protest novels. Things like, this is a category of novels like The Grapes of Wrath, or much of Mark Twain's writing would fall into this category. But that's the style that I like to write in.
Nice. Thank you. And so I think some people might hear nonviolence and think that it means passivism or not doing anything and kind of letting us get run over by that which we do not want. So could you kind of give us a sort of a brief tutorial on nonviolent action and why it's important now and a little bit about what it is?
Sure. Like you said, Erin, it's not passivity. It's not doing nothing. It's not just letting people come along and beat you up because you're not going to be violent back to them. Nonviolent struggle, which is what I teach people and train people in, is a coordinated collective effort that uses over 198 methods of nonviolent action in coordinated campaigns to achieve social justice goals. It's been used all over the world by people of every age, every ethnicity, every racial background, every gender, every political persuasion. And in the last 30 years, there have been 50 nonviolent revolutions, most of which have been successful. We do know at this point that nonviolent struggle is twice as effective as violence in this when it is used in similar types of struggles that we have seen violence used in. We know that it's about a third as fast at achieving its goals as the violent struggles, and that it achieves those goals in with a fraction of the casualties. So it's a pretty potent field of struggle. It's a pretty versatile type of waging struggles for justice, and it includes a lot of tools that can be used by people of various abilities and backgrounds, which is not really a claim that violence can make at this point.
So you, those are some incredible statistics. It's twice as effective, one third as fast, with many less casualties. That's pretty impressive right there. Yeah. And so why do you think it's not being used more often or more widely? Or maybe it is and we just don't hear about it.
I think you hit the nail on the head right there, Erin. If we look at a timeline from 1900 to present day, our rate of nonviolent struggles is going like this, whoosh, right off the chart. It's becoming one of the preferred methods of waging struggle in our world right now, and it's literally changing the landscape of the human world. So the question is, why aren't we talking about this more? Why aren't we training in it? Why isn't Hollywood making movies about nonviolent action? And that, I think, has a lot to do with the culture of violence and our profiteering off of war and violence. That if we have a tool like nonviolent struggle that is so effective, and in our world, we need to say it's cost effective as well. I mean, talk about a fraction of the cost. People who are waging struggle are doing it on shoestring budgets as well. So the question really is, like, where are our priorities as a culture? I mean, it's really important right now for us to take a stark assessment at the ways that we depict conflict and epic struggle. And, you know, in my work, I do that primarily through novels and looking at the story of our time and the stories that we're telling ourselves. If we're always telling ourselves violent stories, we're always going to get violent results in our society. But if we have such a track record with nonviolent struggle, it's really time to start telling a different sort of hero story.
Yes, absolutely. I love that. And I talk a lot about that in my groups and with my clients about the stories that we tell. Even the stories that we tell ourselves are so important. And if we can't tell ourselves a hero story about, hey, here's how we can affect this change, if we can't even imagine that, it's really hard to bring it into being. So I agree with you. Just changing the conversations that we have is really important. And the more people that we have around the country, at least I imagine, having conversations like this, creating groups like the ones that you create, at some point, I think we could create a tipping point where everything has shifted and we're not watching the same movies and we're not reading the same news stories and we're not being pitted against each other in the same ways that we have been. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of hold out a dream for that world as well?
I think it's more than a dream. I think it's an active pursuit in my way of thinking. Like, when I look at the scope of my life's work and what I'm trying to do with my books and novels and the workshops and strategy for nonviolent movements, it's about taking that vision that you so wonderfully articulated and taking your step, whatever that might be, on the path towards tangibly pulling down that vision out of the stardust into the matter and the reality that is our earth. And we have so much aid and help in this journey. And when we look at the lineage of nonviolent struggle, we're not back in 1930 with Gandhi before he did the SALT campaign. We're not back before the civil rights movement gave us their history and legacy. We're not back before the struggles that occurred that broke apart the Soviet Union in the early 2000s and late 1990s. I mean, when we really look at the broad scope of what's happened, we're standing on the shoulders of not giants, but a giant movement of experimentation and application of nonviolent struggle. And I think at this point, the work that is before us is to make sure that we aren't ignoring that history and that lineage and that knowledge, that we're teaching it and passing it on, but then also that we're deeply challenging the archetypes and meta myths and narratives that are perpetuating in our society. It is time for a revolution of values in terms of those big meta narratives. Mm. And in many ways, we are starting to see glimmers of it. I'm thinking about a few years ago, there was a Hollywood production of The Giver, this wonderful book by Lois Lowry, about a giver of memories to a receiver who was a young boy who received all the memories of all time for all the people in his community. And when it came time to give memories of courage, the images that flashed on the screen, and this was not something that was in the book, but the images that flashed on the screen were like a shot of skydiving, a shot of whitewater rafting, and then 10 to 15 images of nonviolent struggle. a definition of courage in our time is people who stand up to oppression, stand up to tyranny, stand up to injustice, make change, but do it without using the mechanism of violence, which is so perpetually harmful and such a vicious cycle that creates more injustice and more violence in our world.
Right, right. That an image just flashed into my head as you were talking, Revere, of that gentleman in Tiananmen Square in front of the tanks, that tiny little man, tiny in body, but huge in spirit, just standing there. And he stopped a whole army of tanks, at least for that moment in time. So
there are many examples, and it is heartening that more and more of the imagery and the memes and the quotes are making their way into our popular culture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You just used a term that I've never heard before, and as I contemplated, I think it's an important one to unpack a little bit, and that's the meta myths of our culture. Could you say a little bit more about those meta myths?
Sure. So I work as a writer. I work as a novelist. I tell big epic stories about change and about human beings, and I don't think I really put any anti-heroes into my novels. I'm just not interested in that kind of character. I always put in heroes and sheroes who are ordinary and extraordinary, like the people like yourself and so many others that I run into over and over over again in our world. And so when I look at what meta-narrative I am telling, what is the big story, big arc of the story, not just the details, not just the characters and the plot, but, you know, a meta narrative might be guy meets girl, they fall in love, end of story. Or guy picks up sword, wages war, wins, is maybe a meta narrative. Or one big meta narrative we've been living under is the meta narrative around conquest and colonization, you know, that might makes right, and that we can plow into the wilderness and take over this so-called wasteland, which is a complete myth from beginning to end. These were inhabited territories that were homes to, and still are in many cases, to many indigenous peoples. So the meta-narratives are the big stories that we're always telling ourselves, and the culture of violence is one, the culture of imperialistic war is another that we're pretty addicted to in this country. And so there are many, like another good one to point out is the capitalist consumer meta-narrative, bigger is better, is a good descriptor of that. These are things that we are all sharing as a narrative, often so broadly that we feel we don't need to articulate them that much, and they are driving many of our thoughts, our philosophies, and the ways that we show up in the world. And we know at this point in time, with the climate crisis, the economic crisis, the geopolitical crisis of war versus peace, so many crises compounding, we know we need to revise that story and really take stock and understand that to be fulfilled as a human being, to live a life of meaning and purpose, does not need to involve subjugating others, dominating others, waging war and violence, destroying the earth. In fact, just the opposite. If we're going to survive as human beings, we're going to have to come up with a vision of what a real hero or shiro of our times is that doesn't replay those old myths and old meta-narratives. It's a great challenge for our generation. If we look at the previous generation, particularly if we go back to baby boomers, they were living under a completely different story, many aspects of which they had to rebel against in the 60s and break up. We too have our rebellion against constraining myths and our visionary work of creating a new myth for how are we going to move forward. And that question of what world are we in and what world are we going to and how are we getting from point A to point B is really where I place all of my works, whether we're talking the Dandelion Insurrection, Billionaire Buddha, The Way Between, Steam Drills, all of them have to do with shifting from old narratives into new narratives.
Wow, beautifully stated, Rivera. And so your work and this body of work around nonviolent action to me, it sounds very empowering, and it's something that I feel like a relatively it doesn't take a lot of people, or even maybe just one person watching this that wants to dive in. It's a way to get empowered, because it's not just a theory, correct? There is a sort of a almost a formulaic set of tools that you can use around this. And maybe a lot of people might know Standing Rock might be the most recent kind of most visible example of this. So could you talk about Standing Rock and how these principles were utilized there in a way that people can kind of wrap their minds around?
Sure. Well, at Standing Rock, it was an Indigenous-led struggle with white and other allies from around the country and across the world. It created a couple of encampments or occupations, as we would say, that created cultural awareness, training in the struggle, support centers for those who are taking direct action to stop and the pipeline construction and to reclaim territory that had been taken by the pipeline company. In addition to all of those parts of the campaign, we also saw solidarity actions nationwide and around the world. We saw some really powerful campaigns around moving your money out of the 15 banks that were financing the pipeline and into local credit unions, preferably. These did create some domino effect of banks pulling out of not just the DAPL pipeline, but also out of other fossil fuel projects. There were a slurry of fossil fuel projects that were canceled during the Standing Rock period. And this is one pattern we often see in our social justice movements, is that even though the campaign in question may not achieve the particular goal that it has set out to do, there's often a ripple effect around it that has advanced the broader movement. In Standing Rock's case, the pipeline did get built. But it's important to know there is, that struggle continues. It's not done. The very well-known scholar Joanna Macy likes to say that anything humans have created, humans can uncreate, humans can take down. And just because a pipeline is built doesn't mean that the oil is always going to flow through that pipeline. It doesn't mean that it's always going to be there on our landscape. And I think that's an important thing to remember about struggle, for better and for worse, that the struggle of the moment is not your panacea to all your problems, whether it succeeds or it fails. There's a lot of people who look at Gandhi's campaign and look at contemporary India and say, well, nonviolent struggle didn't work. Look at India today. But that's really not a fair claim, because what Gandhi's struggle attempted to do had a lot of facets, but was mostly aimed at the self-rule movement of India, which it certainly did achieve. And further campaigns are needed to deal with all the myriad problems that our cultures are facing all over the world. And I think we shouldn't lose heart. I think we should really know our history. We should learn about what works and what doesn't work. And we should learn from both our successes and our setbacks.
Yes. Yes. Well stated. And taking the money out of those banks that was supporting the pipeline is, I think, a perfect example of your phrase that I love, which is withdrawing our cooperating consent from that which we oppose. It was a perfectly nonviolent legal action, mm-hmm. but when enough people take it together at the same time, it brings about change. It makes people sit up and take notice.
Well, and that's really the hinge of how nonviolent struggle works. It doesn't necessarily work because we melt the heart of our oppressor or because we are so morally just and right in our cause. It doesn't happen even because we assemble millions of people in the street to protest something. It happens because when we look at the broader system of the conditions and resources that are supporting and fueling the injustice, we and our movements have been able to pull those resources or block those resources from being accessed by the oppressive force or the injustice in question. And if you cut off enough sources of power to those resources, they simply can no longer exist. It's without water.
Mm. I'm curious what you think about how much of these problematic structures that are now set in place, how much of their action at this point is just inertia, that they're so big that it's just habit and inertia, versus they're really kind of digging their feed in and wanting things to be the way they are. Maybe that's too broad of a question for you to even answer. But as you were talking, it just came to me.
Did you have a couple in mind particularly that were springing up in there?
Well, like the pipeline, for example, and just the fossil fuel industry and things like that, and the government kind of supporting that. Just, I don't know, maybe my idealistic mind can't even believe that they wouldn't say, hey, this is not sustainable, literally, or in any possible way or argument. No, there's no way it's sustainable. So let's figure out a way together to rework it.
Well, I think there's really two parts to answering that question. The first is that the fossil fuel industry has intensively and coordinatedly perpetuated the myth of climate denialism, saying that climate change is not real. And they have done this for over 30 years. I mean, I'm 36 years old, and we could have been living on 100% renewable energy by the time I was 6 years old. So I think there is entrenchment there. It's not just, and there is active coordination to suppress the truth and to continue to make profit in the systems that they have set up. There's a lot of fear in that industry of the fact that they actually do know that the handwriting is on the wall, and they're all trying to make the money while it's there. But I would say, I would caution people against perceiving any oppressive group or an unjust injustice as monolithic and impenetrable, all powerful, because what we've seen around the world is that even the strongest dictators, even the most entrenched problems, are not monolithic. There's a lot of facets to it. There's a lot of components to what makes, say, the fossil fuel industry go around, or even the money in politics that we are struggling with and its effects on our so-called democracy. So what we do in nonviolent struggle is we look for those points of weaknesses, and we look for the divergence in views that exist even within the industry or the system, and we start to remove piece by piece the components that are propping it up. And weakening the position and the stance until we get to a point where the movement is strong enough and the opposition is vulnerable enough that we can strategically target and push to actually block the motion of the movement that they are trying to do or dictators, their entire power position disintegrates and another system, generally a democracy, rises up in its place. Not always. Sometimes you create a power vacuum and something equally nasty steps into it, which is a lesson for activists, is to have a vision and have a plan for the transition to the vision.
Yeah, great point. Great point. So if people are listening and thinking, this really sounds intriguing, what are some steps they can take to start learning more or taking more action on this path?
Yeah, there's so many ways. I would encourage him to read my novels, actually, which is particularly Dandelion Insurrection is a really fun way to jump into the kind of adventure and epicness of a big movement for change. And there are a list of resources in the back of that book, things that inspired me while writing the book. And some of them include things like the Albert Einstein Institution, which is a website that features the work of Gene Sharp, one of the preeminent scholars of strategic nonviolent struggle. I would encourage them to check out the Meta Center for Nonviolence or the Gandhi Institute if they're looking for a principled stance on how to apply principled nonviolence to making change both in your personal life and on the global change scale. I would advise them to go do some reading on the Global Nonviolent Action Database. It's a wonderful resource with over 1,500 case studies of nonviolent struggles and campaigns around the world, and it's pretty heartening, actually, in this time when we think that everything is falling into ruin and collapse and chaos and injustice, to go and read the stories of people who have waged struggle, often for many of the very things that we ourselves know we need to wage struggle to achieve in our world right now.
Could you maybe share one of those case studies that people might not know about, a creative act of nonviolence that got some real results?
Sure. One of the stories I love to tell is about the women of Liberia. And it's such an amazing story because it takes place in around 2001, 2003. And it's during the eruption of the Second Civil War in Liberia. They have a dictator in power, Charles Taylor, who came to power after the first incredibly horrific and bloody Civil War. Much of the populace was displaced, and some of them had returned to the country hoping for peace, only to see this war erupt again between the rebels and Charles Taylor. I mean, massacres are happening left and right. About 800,000 people are living as refugees in Monrovia, the capital. And a woman, Lima Gbowee, has a dream in which she is told to go gather the women and pray for peace. And so she goes to the Christian women, and she goes to the Muslim women, and she goes to the other kinds of religious faiths of women in the country and said, we must gather and pray for peace. So they set up in a fish market that happens to be right outside Charles Taylor's residence, and they start to sing and pray for peace, not just with one or two people, but with 1,500 to 2,000 women. And eventually they demand and gain an audience with Charles Taylor, at which they demand that he sit down to peace talks with the rebels. And he says, if you can get them to do it, I'll do it. So they go to the rebels, and this is a long part of the story I won't relate right now because it's filled with these incredible actions and courage from these women, and they get the rebels to join. So the peace talks start to take place, and the men are stalling their feet. They're literally like posturing and threatening each other and not getting anywhere close to peace. So the women who've been keeping vigil outside where the talks are being held stand up and go and blockade the doors. And they say, you are not coming out until you get to peace. And so they who arrest them, and Lima Gbowee threatens to take off all her clothes, which is one of the worst curses that a woman can do in Africa, is to derobe in front of a man that is not her husband. And that kind of scares the guards back, and they work out a truce that if the men make progress each day, the women will stay back from the doors. But if the men aren't making progress, the women can come barricade the doors again. And within 3 weeks, they reach agreements on those peace talks. They stop the Second Civil War. But even more remarkable, as part of the negotiations of those talks, it ends up that Charles Taylor, the dictator, steps down from power, and democratic elections take place the following year, at which point one of the women who had organized for peace, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, is elected the first woman president of Liberia. Wow. That's just one of the amazing stories that people haven't heard. The East Timorese stopped a genocide from taking place. One third of their populace had been murdered or starved by the Indonesian occupation circa late 1990s, early 2000s. And they used nonviolent struggle to actually wage justice and achieve liberation from Indonesia in the face of a genocide. It's a pretty remarkable story. People always ask me about nonviolence and the Nazis, and there's so many incredible stories that I think we're not going to have time to relate right now. But people should look up what Denmark did to resist the Nazis. Many of us know the story of how they saved their 6,000 Jews, but they don't know the stories about how the Nazis were trying to build warships or get the Danes to build warships to them. And through nonviolent struggle, strikes, slowdowns, walkouts, the Danes did not complete a single warship for the Nazis during the entire 3-year occupation that the Nazis held in Denmark. So the stories go on, and we should know them.
We should know them. Absolutely. So inspiring. And so many. And sure, you could probably spend an hour telling us stories, and we can go and read the stories ourselves and learn and stay encouraged. And I think it's important for us to focus on what's possible, because if we are just the victim of the normal media, it's oftentimes a case study of what's wrong with the world, and we forget that anything is possible. And that what can start with prayers and singing and threats to take off clothes can lead to a whole regime change. I mean, anything is possible when like-hearted people get together creatively with an intention for peace. And so thank you for reminding us of that. So I hope people will go and check out the resources that Rivera mentioned. I hope that you will buy her book, Dandelion Insurrection, and she's got lots of other books. There's one for young people as well, right, mm-hmm. Rivera, for people with kids. What's the, is it The Way Between?
Mm-hmm. The Way Between, which is a fantastic story. I've noticed that people buy it for their grandkids and end up loving it themselves. So it's a wonderful one to share with your kids, to read aloud, very much featuring an Aikido-like martial art and a way of peace. So it's blending action and fantasy with all of the values and the themes we've been talking about today.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I will put all of Rivera's information below, her website, riverasun.com, her social media links. Follow her, connect with her. If you're lucky enough to be in a place where she's doing a workshop in person, run to it. And Rivera, thank you so much for being here with us, and hopefully you've inspired many, you've inspired me to be more educated, to take more creative action, and to get this revolution of values underway. So thank you for your leadership and your heart and everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much for being a part of the movement to get these ideas out there and connect people with them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, goodbye everyone.